Excuse me, I do need to inform all parties that today's conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hopefully, I'm audible out there. So, welcome to the November Charm Telecon. Our speaker today is Dr. Carly Howitt, and Carly's from Southwest Research Institute in Boulder. And she was recently selected as one of the Cassini Participating Scientists. This was a very competitive program in which 12 new individuals were brought on board officially on the Cassini team, even though she's been working with Cassini data for quite some time. The intent of the program was to identify individuals who could provide new expertise that wasn't currently being met by the Cassini project. So that's quite an honor for Carly. And we're going to be welcoming her to the Cassini project in an official way. So she's been working with the Cassini SEERS data, like I said, and in particular with SEERS data on the IC satellites. And she's going to tell us about what that data has told her with respect to thermal anomalies on the icy moons. And the title of her talk is an intriguing one, Powerhouses to Pack People, an update on the recent discoveries by Cassini SEERS on the nature of the icy Saturnian satellite surfaces. So with that, Carly.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Should I move the phone closer to me?
You sound clear, Carly.
Okay. All right. Well, I couldn't think of a longer title than that, so that seemed like a good one to go with. So as per the introduction, I'm Carly Howitt. I work in the Boulder office of the Southwest Research Institute, a lot with John Spencer, and I've been working on Cassini SEERS data now for about maybe six years, but it was quite exciting to be brought officially onto the Cassini mission recently. So as I progress through the slides, I guess I'll just say next slide and we can move through. So moving on to slide two, just the overview slide. This is what I'm kind of going to give the subjects I want to talk about today. I know most of you are familiar with the Cassini SEERS mission. I'm not going to talk on that too much, but I just want to introduce SEERS from the perspective of looking at icy moons. There's some traits of SEERS that are particularly important in the analysis of this data when you're looking at icy surfaces. And then I'm going to go on to talk about some of the research I've been doing in the last few years, mainly focusing on Enceladus, Mimas, and Tethys. So looking at this high heat flow from Enceladus, and I've spent a lot of time trying to quantify what that heat flow is, and then go on to talk about these recently discovered anomalies on Mimas and Tethys. So moving on to the third slide, this is just a brief introduction to SEERS. Most of you know it's Cassini's composite infrared spectrometer. It's the sort of eyes of Cassini in the infrared, and it covers quite a large wavelength range, 1,000 microns. And what's important when you consider icy surfaces is that they're obviously very cold. If you're looking at Saturn or sometimes Titan, the temperatures are much warmer. And so the way in which we can use the detectors is a little more limited. The middle plot shows three blackbody emission curves, one at 133 Kelvin, which is kind of the upper end of daytime temperatures that you'd see on the icy Saturnian satellites. It's kind of the middle of the range for the tiger stripes on Enceladus that we're going to go on to talk about, which is kind of one of the hottest endogenic regions we've seen in the Saturnian system. And as you can see, that sort of falls within FP1 and FP3, FP3's regions. When I say FP, I mean focal plane. And SEERS has three SEERS has three focal planes, FP1, FP3, and FP4. There was an FP2, and it was descoped very early on. So FP1 is kind of the longer wavelength detector, and so it's most sensitive. It encapsulates a lot of the black body curve. So you can see that there's 133 Kelvin, this black curve. The FP1 detector covers a lot of that, but so does FP3. If you look to the shorter wavelength, FP3 sees like the upward slope of these high temperature curves. But then conversely, if you look at the blue line, which is 55 Kelvin, which is kind of nighttime temperatures on the icy satellites, FP3 wavelengths just don't cover any part of their emission curve. So we're very insensitive to nighttime emissions with some of our detectors. So if we go on and change slides now to slide 4, we can see the downside of using FP1. So the upside is that we're sensitive to a whole range of temperatures. The downside is that the FP1 detector is big. It's one basically it's one detector, and it has a field of view of about 4 milliradians across, whereas the other two focal planes, FP3 and FP4, are made up of 10 detectors, so you have some redundancy. If something weird happens in one of the detectors, you're not going to lose all of the data from that period of time or from that observation. And each one is basically an order of magnitude smaller. So we have this difference, which it becomes very important when you start having flybys. So for the ICU Saturnian satellites, we're not in orbit around them. We have flyby observations. And so sometimes when you're on approach and you're very distant, using the bigger FP1 field of view, what we can do, the science we can do that is quite limited. So when we plan observations, we often switch between these two types of detectors because of their different characteristics. And so just bear that in mind when I'm sort of talking about the nature of the observations, because they have some impact on the science you can do with them. All right, so ICU Saturnian satellites. So I moved on to slide number 5. And the blue box just kind of indicates my apologies. I probably should have changed this slide from the talk I gave at SWRI last week. Unless you're aware of the SWRI layout, you've got no idea how far away the elevators are. basically, the three that we're interested in are the three to the left, the three closest to Saturn, Mimas, Enceladus, and Tethys. And these satellites are the kind of inner satellites, the icy Saturnian ones. We also have Iapetus, which on this scale is about 27 meters away, like I say, so it's quite a long way out. And I have done work looking at them all, but the ones nearest to Saturn are most kind of affected by Saturn's tides. We're going to go on to talk about that in a moment. So there's more probability for having tidal heating and energetic heat, but it's also closest, it's in the more energetic part of Saturn's magnetosphere. And so you have to worry about interactions, the bombardment of high-energy electrons and plasma into their surfaces, and the effect that can have. So the sort of more towards Saturn you are, the more there's just a lot more going on. Once you get out, it gets the energy of the electrons that are hitting you decreases. There's kind of just a lot more black space. You're kind of really moved out away from the rings and everything else. So if we slide over to slide 6, these are just some VIS-like images made by Cassini from its camera set of the three satellites we're going to be primarily focusing on. And so the first on the top left is Mimas. It's often referred to as the Death Star. It has this huge crater. Mimas is quite small, and this is a massive crater. It is very close to the size at which it would completely just destroy the moon. And it's kind of located at around its equator, and this crater is called Herschel, and so it's kind of a very dominant feature on Mimas. The rest of it's looks very geologically dead. It looks very cratered and old, with sort of very small and large craters. If we go down onto the bottom left now, this is Tethys. You can see it also has a very large crater. Tethys is bigger than Mimas. It's not really to scale these images. And so that's a dominant feature on Tethys, but it's not quite as dominant on Mimas. And if you look very closely, you can see there's this dark band across Tethys. And we're going to go on to look at that in a bit more detail in a few slides' time. Whereas Mimas doesn't have this dark band, and that's going to be – we're going to talk about that in a while. So the final one is Enceladus, and I'm sure most of you are very aware of Enceladus. I don't want to harp on too much about the big picture details, but it looks very geologically young. If you compare Enceladus and Mimas, you'll see it's a lot less cratered, for example. It's obviously undergone resurfacing. If you look at the bottom right of the Enceladus pictures, you can see the four blue lines, and these are the tiger stripes. They're four fractures or sulci that stretch across basically Enceladus's south polar region, and they are geologically active. We see heat emerging from them and a whole host of other things that we're going to go on to talk about. So these are the targets that we're going to be interested in. If we move to slide 7, just going to quickly introduce what I'm talking about when I say things like albedo and thermal inertia. These are very important when you look at IC satellite surfaces, because they're the dominant surface properties. You can model the surfaces very well if you know these two things, and then other things such as how far away from the sun you are and things like that. But these are the two kind of variables in modeling their surfaces. So when I talk about albedo, I'm talking about the fraction of sunlight that's reflected from a surface. And I give two instances of that. I mean, snow, it's white. You know, when you go skiing, you have to wear goggles and suntan and an extra suntan lotion because the sun reflects very well off of that surface. But if you look at dust or dirt or grass, this has a lower albedo. And these are extremes of what I'm talking about, but it's just to kind of give you a mental picture of what I'm talking about. Thermal inertia is a bit more subtle. We define it as the ability of a surface to store and re-radiate thermal energy. And what that really means is if you can think about a surface, say you think initially thinking about sand, like on the bottom right picture, during the day that sand will get really hot. If you go to the beach on a sandy day, you can't walk on it often. But if you were to walk on things like grass or sometimes even concrete, it wouldn't be as hot. And that's really what we're talking about. It's sort of finer particles, or we usually define it as being less porous particles. And they heat up very quickly and they cool down very quickly, as opposed to something that's solid, like something like concrete, that heats up slowly, but it also cools down slowly. So that's why like walls of a house will feel warmer at night during the summer. That radiation is still coming off of it slowly. So these are the two properties that we're going to talk about. And if we move to slide 8, one of the first pieces of work I did was to look at these properties and how they vary across the Saturnian system. Now, one of my colleagues, Anne Verbischer, used ground-based data to look at the albedo changes across the IC Saturnian satellites. And what she saw is kind of reflected in this result as well, that Enceladus is really bright. Enceladus is basically the most reflective thing out there. It's kind of a snowy white compared to many of the other surfaces. And then as you move away from Enceladus, as you move towards Mimas and Tethys, that albedo decreases. So it becomes sort of less bright as you move away from Enceladus. And what she was able to show is that Enceladus is the reason for that. Enceladus is spewing things out and making an E-ring, the sort of Enceladus ring, if you will, and that's going on to coat its neighbors. And the further away from Enceladus you are, the less you're coated with this kind of pure snow, kind of these kind of whiter particles, and so the darker the surfaces are. If you go down to look at the bottom of the two plots on this slide, you'll see that the thermal inertia doesn't seem to do very much. There's hints that maybe it decreases out towards Tethys and Dione and then ramps up, but the error bars are pretty big. I think on a good day you could probably fit this with pretty much a straight line. And so it's difficult to draw anything conclusive differences in the Saturnian system. It's difficult to conclude anything about that. But if we move on to slide number 9, what is very obvious if you compare the thermal inertia of, say, the Saturnian systems, which is shown in the table at the bottom on the third row in, to the values in the Jovian system, which is shown in the same table above it. If you ignore Io, it's not really comparable, it's more a volcanic surface than an icy surface, you can see that the thermal inertias in the Jovian system are much higher. So whilst we can't say very much about how the thermal inertia varies across the Saturnian system, we can say that it varies significantly between the Jovian satellites and the Saturnian satellites. So if we go on to slide 10, what does that tell us? Well, what it tells us is that the Saturnian IC satellites must have like a grainier surface, a more porous surface. And this is a very hand-waving way of explaining it, but it kind of illustrates the difference. And it's so when we think of Saturnian satellites, often they're going to have a more porous surface. It's not going to be kind of grainy, but it's going to be less well-packed than the Jovian surfaces, even though the albedos and the compositions are very similar. Okay, so that's by way of a kind of overview of all of the satellites. So the next slide moves us on to Enceladus. And as we all know, Enceladus is a really interesting target. There's so much going on in the Enceladus system. The top left-hand plot of, we're now on slide 11, shows the South Polar Terrain's jets. And these are, they've been shown to be emerging from the tiger stripes. They're fast-moving. They're predominantly water ice. I'm going to go on to talk about some of the other constituents of the jets and why they're important. It was somewhat of a surprise. No one was really expecting to see this type of activity from Enceladus. It was always possible that Enceladus was going to be active, but just the magnitude of what we're seeing is really surprising. And the bottom right-hand plot here shows Enceladus in its E-ring. I mentioned before that, you know, the closer you are to Enceladus, the more you're going to get coated in this kind of white dust that's going to brighten your albedo. And that's really what this is showing. This is sort of showing that white dust of the E-ring, or white sort of ice of the E-ring, rather, it's not dust, that's contaminating or brightening, however you want to phrase it, Enceladus's neighbors. So it's definitely an interesting target. So if we move on to slide 12, this is a close-up of the South Polar Terrain. And these are the four fractures that I showed earlier in blue. And they're all named things from the Arabian Nights. That was the theme of the nomenclature on Enceladus. And so we have Damascus, which has got a branch in the bottom left-hand corner, Baghdad, Cairo, and Alexandria. And these four stripes have really been the focus of a lot of work, especially by myself and John Spencer, amongst others. And if we move on to the next slide, this is some of the early results that John Spencer found. This is slide 13. And there's a lot of information on this slide, so I'm just going to briefly talk through it. The Roman numerals indicate plume sources. This was found by Joseph Spital and Carolyn Porco using Cassini ISS images, and they triangulated the images and found where the plume sources must be. So there's a number of plume sources. And then the red patches with green lettering show particularly warm regions that we saw with Sears. That this was in the first paper John published back in 2006. And so you can see some areas, like that branch of Damascus, are really quite bright. Like, why isn't the other branch bright? There's lots of interesting questions that fall out of these findings. Okay, so now we know that some bits are warm, but one of the remaining questions, well, how warm is warm? If we move on to the next slide, slide 14, this gives us the number. So it's likely that Enceladus has some minerals that break down, that are radioactive, that break down and release heat. And the number that's been put on that, the estimate for the amount of heat that could produce is about 0.3 gigawatts. That was a result by Carolyn Porco's paper in 2006. But what we have to include next is we think that Enceladus has probably got some tidal heating going on. It's probably got some endogenic heating. And so the next thing was to try and estimate that. How much tidal heating do we have? Before I want to go on, I'm sure most of you are aware of what tidal heating is, but just very briefly, we're aware of what tides are. We have them on the Earth. They're very familiar. And basically, all moons move around their kind of target in an elliptical orbit. And the closer they are, like in this slide, the position on the right-hand side, Enceladus is really going to get squeezed towards Saturn. And then as it kind of moves around its orbit, as it moves anti-clockwise or counterclockwise around its orbit, it's kind of going to get pulled and squished in different ways. And that pulling and squishing basically heats the kind of center and the kind of insides of Enceladus, and that will be released. And this is a process that can be modeled. We can have, if we have to make some assumptions to model it, but we have kind of our own moon helps us determine the nature of these models, and then we have to adjust it for the Saturnian system where there are a lot more bodies, and so there's a lot more interactions and fun stuff. But we can kind of get a handle on how much tidal heating we think there's going to be. And if we move on to slide 16, the number that was found was 1.1 gigawatts. We anticipate that if it's steady state, so that means if it's very stable, if it's able to continue in the way it is, we'd expect to see 1.1 gigawatts from this tidal heating. Okay, moving on to slide 17, but what you actually find is that the initial estimate that John found in terms of how hot Enceladus was, how much heat is coming out of Enceladus, it was much higher than this. So if we move to slide 18, you don't have to be a maths whiz to determine that 0.3 plus 0.11 really don't equal the lower bounds of the endogenic heat that we're seeing from Ceres. So that's 3.9 gigawatts. So it begs the question, what's going on? Moving on to slide 19. So this is maybe when we think about the nature of the observations that we used to come up with that value. This was made using FP3 observations. And if we go back to the graph that we showed earlier, we can see that FP3 is only really sensitive to high temperatures. So maybe there's cooler endogenic emission also that's kind of being ignored, or that preferentially we're seeing warmer temperatures, and so that's sort of skewing our results somehow. So we were very keen to go back and use FP1 data, where we're going to be sensitive to both cool and warmer emission, and see if we can refine this number and make it more accurate. And so the observations that we chose to do this were these two. I moved on to slide 20. There were two stair observations, and by stair I mean the spacecraft is basically sort of moving either towards Enceladus or away from Enceladus, and we're looking at one spot, and the target size during that time isn't changing very much. And so the observations are shown in gray on the top two plots. So we had two stairs, one in March 2008, one in October 2008. And the October ones are slightly skewed because we're not looking exactly straight down at the South Pole. We're actually, the straight down spot was slightly to one side. But in this plot, it's shown at the South Pole. So that's why it looks skewed, but it's using the same detector. And then the bottom plots just show the spectra that you got from these observations. These are the FP1 spectra. The gray are the individual spectra. The red is the mean. And so if we move on to the next slide, which is slide 21, we want to know how much power is coming out. That's the term that we use. That's like the total number of the total amount of thermal emission. And that's actually quite straightforward to do. If you have a spectra, you can basically just integrate under the curve, and you kind of integrate over the solid angle that you're seeing, and the area that it's coming from. And Bob's your uncle. You have your power. But in the case of FP1, moving on to slide 22, there's an extra thing that we have to worry about, which is the amount of radiation. Enceladus is re-radiating, so the re-radiation of just sunlight that's hitting it. And that's not the number that we really want. We want the sort of extra or bonus thermal emission we're getting from Enceladus. And so this process, so the first thing we have to do is kind of estimate the passive emission, estimate how much sunlight Enceladus is like re-radiating. And this, it turns out, is really complicated. There's a whole bunch of stuff that has to go into the model. I don't really want to dwell on it too much. I'm going to mention a few things in the next slides, but we're basically kind of going to sort of scroll through it, not to dwell on the details too much. I just want to give you a kind of hint of the things, all the things that we had to worry about. Okay, so moving on to slide 23, these are all basically the things that go into our models. If we want to model a surface temperature, we need to worry about the heliocentric distance. How far is it from the sun? It's intricity, so we need to know what time of year it is. If it's in summer, it's going to be – and the two things are linked, of course. But if we're doing seasonal models, there's going to be that dependence. We need to know its rotation period. How quickly does the target that you're looking at move? The subsolar latitude – so that we know whether we're in northern summer or southern summer. The latitude that you're interested in, so obviously it's going to be colder at the poles than it is going to be at the equator. The local time, are we looking at the day or the night or the afternoon or whatever? Eclipses, does the satellite have eclipses? When does it have eclipses? How long do they last for? How much cooling is associated with those eclipses? Saturn shine. If you're standing on Enceladus and you look into the sky, Saturn is big on the side that faces the target. And so you have to worry about not only the reflected sunlight that Saturn's putting out, but the heat of Saturn. Saturn sits around 90-something Kelvin, and so that's going to have an emission too. So I lump that in as Saturn shine. And then finally, the properties of the surface itself, the bolometric bond albedo and the thermal inertia. And the final thing that we have to worry about is exactly the spatial distribution of the emission. I'm going to go on to explain why we need to worry about that in a moment. Those are the inputs. And then the plot on the right basically shows you the diurnal curves that you get out. So the bottom is local time, or 180 is midday, 0 is midnight. And we get it sort of at the closest point and at the furthest away. So perihelion, the solid line, you're getting the maximum daytime temperatures, and aphelion is a dashed line. So it's slightly that at the equator, the temperatures are going to vary between these two lines. Okay, so quickly talking about Saturn shine and eclipses. We looked, these observations happened to be taken around equinox, and it turns out that these two effects, so the cooling you get due to eclipses and the warming that you get from Saturn shine, basically cancel out. And the left-hand plot shows a diurnal curve with or without an eclipse. Obviously, the solid line with the duck out, sudden decrease in temperature that's the eclipse period. And the right-hand plot here slide 24. I hope everyone's keeping up. Just shows the temperature difference that you'd see if you cut across the south polar terrain from night to day, and it basically shows that the temperatures change by about 2 degrees Kelvin, whether you include these or not. So it's an effect, but it's not a big effect. All right, thermal inertia, moving on to slide 25. We don't really know what the thermal inertia of Enceladus is. We know that it's low, at least at the surface we know that it's low. We don't really have a good feel for its deep value. So we considered three scenarios, all of which have this 27 MKS value somewhere in it. That was a value that was previously determined close to the south polar terrain. So scenario one includes it to deep levels. Scenario two includes it to about 2 centimeters, and then we ramp up the thermal inertia to a value that we saw it was constrained to be in the northern hemisphere of 100 MKS. And then the final scenario has this 27 MKS sort of top surface, and then a deep high value, 1,000 MKS, is approximately the value of pure water ice. We could have chosen different ones. There were arguments for other scenarios. You have to choose something. We went with this for the rationale that I've just outlined. The next thing we have to worry about is albedo. And this plot comes we're now on page 26. This slide comes from some work that I did earlier on, and it kind of constrains the albedo and thermal inertia towards the south polar terrain. It only goes to 60 south because then it all kind of gets messy. But you can see that in the southern hemisphere, you see albedos between 0.75 and 0.84. And the bottom plot on the right, labeled plot B, just shows the effect of albedo. The brighter something is, the more sunlight it's able to reflect, the cooler the temperature. Albedo is something we need to worry about, and we use three different albedos to kind of get a feel, like a sensitivity study of how important they were. 0.6, 0.72, and 0.8 were the values that we used. Again, there were probably arguments for using others, but those seem like a reasonable spread. Okay, so now we have most of our model inputs. We can go on to try and verify our models. That's always a good thing to do. So moving on to page 27. Now, it's not very easy to verify models of the south polar terrain because you really want to get a spot that's got the same surface characteristics but that doesn't have any endogenic emission at all. And it's basically impossible to rule out the fact that a given spectra has zero endogenic emission. But what we did was kind of make that assumption that the bulk of the endogenic emission is going to be coming from the tiger stripes. And so observations that are very small, like have a very small, very good high spatial resolution, a narrow field of view, are going to have less endogenic emission included in them. And so the plot on page 27 on the left-hand side shows observations that we had from around that period that fulfilled that specification. They're within the South Polar terrain, but they're not on a tiger stripe. And I've just shown one of the examples here. We did the same thing for all of these lettered values on the left-hand side. I think there are about 8 in total. And basically the model results are the same for kind of all of them. So I could have chosen any of them. I just happened to go with A. And so the field of view for the spectra I'm going to be talking about is shown in the bottom left-hand side in blue of that left-hand plot. And so if we move to looking at the spectra, you can see that the spectra that we saw, the SEER spectra, is the blue line that's kind of hidden right at the back. The dotted line is our noise level. And then we have a bunch of model fits laid over the top of it. If we move to slide 28, you can see that we can rule out some of the models pretty quick. The low albedo ones, the 0.6 and 0.72, those pink and green lines that are towards the top of the plot, don't come anywhere near to our value, our observed radiance. So we can rule out those values. The values at the bottom, we kind of played with the albedo a bit to see whether we needed to worry about how it varied with incidence angle, and it turned out we didn't. But we can't rule out any of the thermal inertia scenarios. They all provide a fit within error for an albedo of 0.8. So we have to include all of those scenarios in our final model. Okay, so moving on to slide 29. I mentioned earlier that we had to worry about the spatial distribution of the endogenic emission. I'm not going to dwell on this, but the top right-hand plot shows what the FP1 instrument function is. So the FP1 detector is most sensitive in the middle of its field of view. It's less sensitive to something in kind of the edges of its field of view. And when you look at the tiger stripe emission, which is shown in the bottom left plot, you can see that it's really not uniform. It definitely is brighter along the stripes. And so this is just something we have to worry about. And we came up with three models for looking at this response. One, we assumed that the emission was all from the tiger stripes, but it was uniform. The second model is that it was all from the tiger stripes, but varied according to the figure on the left. And the third is that it was independent of tiger stripe location, but came from the middle of the field of view. And it's very non-physical, but it allows us to set some bounds on how important this effect is. Okay. So, getting back to the data, let's move on to slide 30. So here we have the top plot show in color, the blue and the red show the radiances that we saw, the SEER spectra that we saw from those two stair observations I showed earlier. The black lines are a model guess, basically. So depending on the model, you assume those black lines are going to wiggle around a bit, but it's just to give you an idea of how much difference there is. So the difference between those two all comes from endogenic emission. So it's not like we're kind of close to it. There's a big difference. There's obviously something else weird going on Enceladus. The purple line, again, is just an indicator of noise. And you can see that below about 400 wave numbers, it's pretty low in magnitude. All right. So it's the difference between these two curves, between the colored curve and the black curve, on these plots that are plotted on the next figure on slide 31. So depending on exactly what you assume, depending on the thermal inertia scenarios you assume, depending on how you think the emission is going to vary across the field of view, you end up with these two residuals, those differences between the modeled and the observed fit. And there's a lot of information on these plots. So basically, I'm just going to quickly talk through it. By uniform and non-uniform distribution, so for example, the difference between the black and the purple line is the spatial distribution we assume for the endogenic emission, for the tiger stripe emission. And the difference between, say, the black and the purple and the blue and the green are the different observations. Rev 61 was that first stair observation that was more circularized. Rev 91, it was the second observation that was taken later in the year that is kind of was almost more elliptical. At the bottom of the plot, if you look very closely at the higher wave numbers, you'll see a brown line. And that was the data that John Spencer originally had to estimate the endogenic emission. And the fit to it, the fit that he gave to the lion is shown in red. And you can see it does a pretty good job of fitting the data. And when you extrapolate it back to lower wave numbers, you can see that this curve is so much lower than our model fits. So what that tells us is the endogenic emission, John determined this 5.8 gigawatts, which was the area basically under that curve, is going to be a lot lower than what the actual value is. And when you do the maths, when you do the statistics of the different model fits and the way that you can do it, you end up with a value of about 15.8 gigawatts. So it's almost three times what John originally saw. So that's going to make it even harder to understand. So if we move on to slide 32, now our math gets really complicated because 0.3 and 0.11 really didn't equal 3.9, and it really doesn't equal 12.7 gigawatts, which is now the lower end of the value that we estimate in this work. So what's going on? If we move on to slide 33, there's a few different ideas. So this number is really hard to describe. I got pretty unpopular, I think, in the modeling community when we announced this number, because they could almost get to 5.8 if they could fudge it a bit. 15 point something is a long way off. So there's a few ideas of what could be going on. One is we made the assumption earlier in that tidal heating number that we're in steady state, that basically Enceladus could keep going like this, you know, for a very long time. But maybe that's not true. Maybe what Enceladus does is it gets tidally heated and it stores it and it stores it and it stores it. And then occasionally it goes through kind of a release episode. It kind of goes bam. And when we just happen to be seeing Enceladus during that period. Another option is that it's not steady state because Enceladus' intrinsicity has changed. There's something that's changed in its tidal heating. Perhaps at one point it was more eccentric, and so it was getting more tidal heating, and it's kind of the remnants of that we're seeing. Or maybe there's a problem with our models. The models use far more in way of inputs than just Enceladus' eccentricity. It also is heavily constrained by the amount of heating it thinks Saturn can get. But if this is wrong, if the number that goes into the model is wrong, and there are various reasons why that number is constrained to the one it is, primarily looking at how orbits, orbital evolution. But if that number is wrong, if it's too high, then it might be that the heating that we're seeing is stable and it's our models that are wrong. That's always a possibility. So we don't really know why the heat flow from Enceladus is so high, but we can take a stab at what it means. So if we move on to page 34, what does it really mean? And it really is very hard to get this sort of heating if you don't have liquid water. It in itself isn't evidence for liquid water. There's always other ways that you can describe it, but they get less and less sort of plausible, perhaps, if you can't include liquid water. And so we can't really constrain with this number whether we're talking about a sub-surface global ocean, a local South Polar Sea, or like pockets of water that just happen to be below the South Polar terrain. We can't really move, we can't really constrain between those. So what else do we know about Enceladus? Well, there's lots of results that have been published from various instruments aboard Cassini, and these are kind of two of the most important results, I think, in contributing towards this discussion about the type of liquid water there must be and how it's produced. Ammonia was observed recently in the plumes, and ammonia is basically an antifreeze. It means that to get liquid water, it doesn't have to be warmer than 0 degrees Celsius, than 273 Kelvin, but rather you can get liquid water down to 176 Kelvin, about minus 143 Fahrenheit, which means that you don't have to keep the water as warm. So it's very important for getting liquid water and keeping liquid water on Enceladus. The other thing that was very exciting was salt-rich particles were observed in the plume. And what this means is, in the same way that the Earth's oceans are salty, Enceladus' ocean must be salty. And you get salt because the water touches the bedrock, and it kind of leaches out those minerals. And so that gives us kind of another piece of information for Enceladus' ocean. So moving on to slide 36, there's lots of ideas on how, there's about at least five different models out there on how Enceladus' plumes exactly work. But this, I think, gives a reasonable picture of our current understanding. And so working from the bottom up, we can see there's a base bedrock, and it's kind of leaching minerals, it's leaching sodium and various other things into the water. In whatever that is, whether it's a global ocean or localized sea. And then there are these kind of regions where you end up with kind of pockets that in the ice shell, for whatever reason, that basically bubbles are rising up into these pockets and they're pressurizing. And the pressure inside is so high, it's able to sort of squeeze these the burst bubble, kind of the contents of the burst bubble, sometimes with some frozen bubble included, up through the ice shell and out through the tiger stripes and into space where we observe them. There are lots of different ideas exactly how this could happen, whether it's almost evaporation is not the correct word, or whether you have to have this sort of pressure chamber. But because the jets are so fast, if they're not pressurized, it's kind of, if you don't have something like this where you have this pressurizing bit, it's kind of hard to explain. And so this is kind of, I think, the essence of what our understanding is currently leading us towards. So just moving on quickly to page 37, this was the press release that came out of the big number, basically, that we released. It was a JPL story press release that came out in March this year, and I was trying to come up with a way of describing just how big 15 gigawatts is. Like, what does it mean? And so this was what we came up with. So each of these sort of black smoky things is the amount of energy produced by one coal-powered power station. And so we're expecting about two kind of power stations worth from Enceladus. But what we saw was a lot more than that. And I think this is just a nice illustration of exactly kind of how surprising this result was. We really weren't expecting to see all the heat that we did. Okay, so if we move on to slide 38, we're going to take a break from Enceladus and move on to Mimas and Tethys, otherwise known as Pac-Man. So this was the press release that was JPL3 press release the year before, March 2010. And I don't know how many people have seen this or not, so I'll quickly just talk over the main details. The top left-hand figure shows the expected temperature. Using those models that I just talked about from Enceladus, we can adapt them for Mimas. And this is what we expect to see. The white dot is a subsolar point. So it's warmer in kind of the afternoons, cooler in the mornings, pretty standard, just like we get on Earth. If you look on the top right-hand plot, that shows what we actually saw. So instead of getting these nice kind of concentric circles of temperatures, you end up with this weird V-shape thing, V-shaped anomaly. It's about it cools about 15 degrees Kelvin over about 15 kilometers, which is really fast. It's kind of crazy. It's centered, the V is centered on the kind of equator on about the anti-Saturn hemisphere. If you look at the bottom left-hand plot, that's a Vis light map of Mimas, similar to the one that I showed you earlier. And you can see that you don't see any trace of albedo change across the surface. So we weren't expecting to see anything on Mimas. We were expecting it to kind of be a little boring, maybe, it's very geologically dead, not perhaps the most exciting target. So this was a big surprise. And so if we move on to slide 39, this was the press release, so they turned it into 1980s video icon glows on Saturn Moon, and really Pac-Man on Death Star really came out of this. And the next slide just kind of shows the coverage that we got. This was my, I guess, least favorite one. I'm not sure where Waka 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 came from, but it certainly haunted me subsequently. It was kind of neat that it hit so many things, but it was kind of interesting. All right, moving on to slide 40. So we ended up being able to negotiate with the Cassini SOST group, which is the IC Saturn working group, for more time to observe Mimas. And as an aside, it was kind of an interesting kind of story as to how we got this time. I looked at this Mimas data because we were having this meeting and people were reporting on it, and I was like, oh, all right, didn't really want to. Thought it was going to be pretty dull. Saw this kind of neat thing, started talking about it, and it literally, like, almost pulled an all-nighter to kind of get the data out, get it done, get it, convince ourselves that we're seeing what we're seeing in order to put something together, to put it forward to SOS to get this data. So it was kind of a lucky, maybe not lucky, but a kind of last-minute ditch effort to get these final two data sets. But I'm so glad we did, because if you look at the data, you can see, so the left-hand plot on page 40 shows the figure that I recently just showed. So you have this warmer region. It's the daytime plot. So you have this kind of cooler region to the right. It's cooler in the daytime. The Rev 139, the middle plot, is almost the same longitude. So you're almost looking in the same spot. You can see that same region is warmer at night now than it was, than its surroundings. So the same area is cooler during the day and it's warmer at night. I should point out that the reason you get a yellow background in Rev 139 is that it's against Saturn. So you're seeing Saturn in the background, which at these wavelengths looks very uniform. The final observation was Rev 144, which is shown on the right-hand side. And now you're looking more towards the kind of lower longitude, so more on the sort of right-hand boundary of the anomaly. And you can see that, again, this is a daytime observation. The sort of middle region is cooler than its surroundings at night. You're almost seeing kind of the inverse of the Pac-Man. All right, so when we reproject these onto a kind of more normal map, page 41 now, this is what you see. So, again, this map's got quite a lot of information in. There's a few things I'd like you to take away. So first thing I should point out, on the October observations taken last year, the gray area is where we have data, but it's too cold. These are an FP3 map, and so anything below 65 Kelvin, we don't have good signal to noise. We know that it can't be warmer than 65 Kelvin, but it could be any temperature below that. So that's why you kind of get this grayed out area in 2010. I think what's the important takeaway from this is we see it in all data sets. This wasn't just this one-time weird glitch thing. It's there, and we see it in the daytime observations and at nighttime at high spatial resolution and at low spatial resolution. All right. So from these data sets, if we move on to slide 42, we can go on to determine some things about its surface thermal properties. And so the left-hand plots just show the spectra. So I'm considering two regions, conveniently called regions 1 and regions 2. Region 1 is outside of the anomaly. Region 2 is inside. So region 1 is that black square shown on the plot, sort of on the left-hand side, and region 2 is the pink square on the right. And the colors of the spectra reflect the colors of the boxes. So the gray, all of the SEER spectra that fell in the gray box are shown in gray on the left-hand side, and the same thing with the pink. And then the top two plots show the daytime temperatures from the map shown on the right, and then the bottom plots show the nighttime temperatures. Kind of hard to do this with the laser pointer. Okay, the other thing should be pointed out is for region 1, orbit 139, this is the nighttime observations. And so over the top of the spectra I've just plotted, what you'd expect to see for various temperatures, and you can see that this spectra is just noise. There's nothing in there. I've shown where 65 Kelvin will lay, and that's why we chose 65 as being a kind of our upper limit. All right. So using those temperatures, we can go on to determine, we can go on to constrain what the surface properties may be. So this is now slide 43. On the right slide, those are our two maps, our day side on the above and the nighttime on the below maps. And the top lines for regions 1 and regions 2 show the diurnal curves that are able to fit the observed temperatures. So the boxes are the temperatures observed. The height of the box is the error of the temperature, and the width of the box is the local time variation across that box. On the right, the very right-hand side at the top, you can see that we can't constrain that nighttime observation in region 1 other than to say it has to be less than 65 Kelvin. So you end up with quite a spread of thermal inertias because it's not as well, of diurnal curves because it's not as well constrained. If we look at the top middle plot now, the diurnal curves here are much tighter. We have a much better temperature constraint. If we now move to the bottom, the left-hand side kind of bottom plots, so the crosses rather than the curves, these show the albedos and thermal inertias that are able to fit our temperatures. And the thing to take away really from this plot is that they don't overlap. The thermal inertias don't overlap, but the albedos do. So the range of the albedos on the left-hand plot kind of overlaps that of the middle plot, but the height of the albedo, the thermal inertias on the left-hand plot are low. They're less than 20, whereas in the middle plot it shows that the thermal inertias inside the anomaly are much, much higher. So this is kind of intuitively what you'd expect. I guess at this point we should probably move on to slide 44 before I talk through all those points. So we see low thermal inertias outside of the anomaly and high thermal inertias inside of the anomaly. But we see the same sort of albedos, which makes sense because we don't see anything in the Vis light map about this this anomaly. And so when you compare those thermal inertias to the values that you see across the Saturnian system, you can see that they're very much in keeping with values that you see there. But inside of the anomaly, where it gets high, 66 MKS, it's much more comparable to the surfaces of, say, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. We weren't really expecting that. Seemed like an odd result, but there you are. So the next obvious question was, are there more pack people? Slide 45. And the quick and dirty answer to that is shown on slide 46. Yes, Tethys. So Tethys is the second closest to Mimas. You have Mimas, Enceladus, and Tethys. Enceladus has a world of stuff going on. It was unlikely that a sort of something like this, which takes a long time to build up, was going to have to be seen on Enceladus because there's so much resurfacing. So what we have here at top plots are the observed temperatures on Tethys. And so in the right-hand top plot, you can clearly see there's sort of this Pac-Man-type shape. On the left-hand plot, it's a little more difficult to see, but what this is a nighttime map that was made. The white dot is the kind of daytime temperature, and you can see that in the middle of the night, it warms up, which is very odd. We don't expect to see that. And so there's something weird going on Tethys too. The bottom plots here show the predicted temperatures for those time periods, and you can see that where you'd expect the warmest parts to be. So for the left-hand plot, you'd expect it to be kind of gradually cooling down throughout the night, something sort of very gradual and continuous. And then on the right-hand plot, you can see that actually the subsolar point, that white point on the top right-hand plot, it is cooler there than it is at higher latitudes and further away from it. So it's kind of cooler. It's cooler in the middle of the day than it is in the kind of early afternoon, which intuitively doesn't make a lot of sense. You wouldn't expect to see that. So we can go on and sort of do the same thing. This time I've chosen. So what I should say we had two sets of observations taken in September 2011. The first one was shown earlier. That was kind of the Pac-Man shape. The second overlapped with our June 2007. We had the same longitude coverage, roughly. And so we can use this constraint of nighttime and daytime coverage to determine some of the things about thermal surface properties. And I chose three boxes to do that. They're shown on the figure. Okay, so doing exactly the same thing I did for Mimas, we use the temperatures, the daytime and nighttime temperatures inside those boxes to constrain what models can fit it. And this is basically the result. So the warm on those curves on the bottom of this, on now on slide 48, show the daytime temperatures. The cooler, the lower temperature, the kind of blue boxes show the nighttime temperatures of box 1, box 2, and box 3. And you can see that only a few this time diurnal curves are able to fit it. And if we go on now to slide 49, this wasn't because we sampled it less often. It was because simply less combinations are able to fit this data. It's a tighter constraint. And what you can see is whilst the albedos, so we're now on slide 49, comparing the thermal inertias and albedo combinations that are able to fit these boxes, you can see again the albedos are pretty much the same, actually much more similar, much more tightly constrained than on MIMAS, but the thermal inertias increase, so we're moving from 5 to 11 to 21. So that means that, that the higher the thermal inertia, the less porous it is, the more maybe more compact it is. So something's compacting the surface inside the anomaly on both MIMAS and Tethys, but leaving the albedo relatively well alone. All right. So we did one extra thing for Tethys. I'm currently doing this for MIMAS. I think if I hadn't have broken my elbow or had an extra couple of days to work on this, I could have shown something similar for MIMAS. And this shows maps. So I've kind of done the same thing, but across the surface now of Tethys. And you can see that the albedo sort of sits around 0.7 on the top map. It does vary a little bit, mainly towards the edges where the data quality gets a bit poorer. But the bottom map really does show that thermal inertia is increasing towards lower longitudes and equatorial values. It's kind of uniform outside of that value. And the values that I'm happy putting on it right now is that outside of this thermal anomalous region, the thermal inertia is less than 10. Above, inside the thermal anomalous region, it ramps up to being greater than 35. So we're getting there, I promise, but the final question I think we have to ask ourselves is, how are these anomalies being formed? They're pretty weird. How are they coming about, and how are we seeing them on so many targets? So if we move on to slide 52, I'm going to start talking about someone else's work. This is work that's done by Paul Schenk. He used ISS images, so Cassini camera images of MIMAS and Tethys. And ISS doesn't only see in the visible, it also sees other wavelengths. And he did some ratio work here. He took the images that you saw in the IR and ratioed them with the UV to produce these maps. And what jumps out at you is these dark bands on the leading hemisphere, so between 0 and 180 degrees longitude, on both MIMAS and Tethys, centered around the equator. And Paul went on to show, if we switch to slide 43, that these areas are very well correlated with areas of high energy electron bombardment. And these white lines overlaid onto those figures show the contours of this electron, the electron flux, and the dotted lines on both figures show the contour that's best able to fit the kind of color boundary of this kind of dark IR UV region. And so an obvious question was, well, do these contours also constrain the thermal anomaly? If we move on to slide 54, these are all the MIMAS figures that I showed earlier, and the dark lines are the contours. And the quick answer is yes, especially if you look at the middle plot on the nighttime data. You can see that the area between the kind of area before the drop-off where we have these warmer nighttime temperatures is very well constrained by these contours. If you look at the bottom left-hand plot now, and this is the lower spatial resolution data, and it's capped at a mission angle of about 60 degrees. If you relax that constraint, the data quality decreases, but the longitude coverage increases. And if you look at that data, you can see that it follows the same contours if you look at, up to about 0 degrees longitude. So it looks like the eastern and the western boundaries both follow these contours on MIMAS. If we switch and we now look at Tethys, again, the same answer is there's a clear correlation here too. I think the most recent data set, so the middle and the bottom plot, really do show this. that dotted line seems to cut in right under that warm region in the middle plot, and you kind of get this cool notch at the equator. And then if you look at the left-hand bottom plot, right under that white arrow, it's quite warm. That's where the subsolar point is. But if you start looking at lower longitudes, you can see that the temperature decreases quite quickly, and you end up with kind of another kind of cool notch in daytime temperature that's at the other end of this boundary. So I think there's a clear correlation in the Tethys data too. So what could be causing this? Well, you'll have to excuse the nature of this figure. As I mentioned a moment ago, I managed to break my elbow a little while ago, and drawing nice figures in PowerPoint became incredibly difficult. But this is basically the story that we think is happening. So Mimas and Tethys are quite close to Saturn. They're bombarded by high-energy electrons, and the high-energy electrons preferentially bombard equatorial latitudes. And that's the mechanism of why that happens is quite well understood. And so what we think is happening is these electrons are getting into the surface to about centimeter depth, and they're sort of exciting ice molecules in there. And so the ice molecules, we know that the original surface, or the unaltered surface of these satellites, has quite a low thermal inertia. The ice grains are sort of touching at very discrete points. It's not a clump of ice. It's more like grains that have got these discrete contact points. And what we think is happening is the molecules in the ice are kind of wiggling and jiggling, and they're basically forming more contact. So the ice grains are kind of being almost, it's not squished together, but the amount of ice touching between the grains is increased over centimeter depth. And what's important about the depths at which these high-energy electrons are able to penetrate the surface is that these are also the depths that change with diurnal temperature. So these are the depths that we're sensitive to with SIRS, because those are the depths that are altered on a daily basis by the sunlight. When you get to deeper levels, the effect of diurnal temperatures is almost negligible, and it becomes seasonal effects that are the dominant force. So it seems like we have a consistent picture here, so that these high-energy electrons are coming in, they're changing the nature of the surface, that's probably changing somehow the way that UV light is scattered, and it's also changing exactly the nature of the surface and its ability to move and to store and re-radiate this heat. And so the final slide is the conclusions. Our conclusions are quite simple, really. We're seeing a lot more heat flow from Enceladus, and we see these weird thermal anomalies on Mimas and Tethys. Understanding why those regions are there and the implications of those regions are a bit more complicated, but that's our basic result. So I think at that point I'll thank you for your time and see if anyone's come up with any questions.
Great, Carla, thank you. Any questions out there for our speaker? I forget how this all evolved with the energetic particles. Was that anticipated ahead of time?
So, we always knew that Enceladus had an active magnetosphere. That was quite well known. What wasn't really known was the kind of details of that, and that's come out of, there's an instrument on Cassini called LEMS, and Chris Peranicus and Bob Johnson have done a lot of work with that instrument and kind of refining their models. So we know now a lot more about where these electrons will bombard the moons and how energetic those electrons are. So it's kind of been a refinement process of something that we suspected went on but couldn't really quantify.
Any questions?
Back to Enceladus, is there evidence that the subsurface liquid is actually water and not liquid ammonia or some other liquid?
Oh, it's almost definitely liquid water. It would be for a variety of reasons. I mean, the plumes are very well sampled, and we see water in that. If you just think about when people that do this think about how things are formed, getting that much ammonia, it is pretty unlikely. And so it doesn't take a lot of ammonia to work as an antifreeze, and it took them quite a long time to find ammonia in the plumes. It wasn't initially discovered. It was only with subsequent lower flybys and kind of more data that they were able to confirm that that was observed. So it's definitely liquid water. It's more of how much and where.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
And it's back to the water, and I'm afraid I missed some of that answer because I had to divert to a different call. But so I don't know if you may have answered it, but I missed the connection between the high heat flow requiring water. I mean, where or
no, we didn't answer that. So basically, the heating from Enceladus we think comes from tidal heating. And that's kind of a flexing and a sort of squishing of the surface of the satellite. And if you think about the way in which things like rock and water deform, they're quite different. And so it's much easier to deform water, to squish water, and for that water to release the energy. I mean, you can have convection and conduction, and you know, like it's much more of a sort of obviously a fluid process. It's just a more efficient process. If you squish rock, it is able to convect, but it's less efficient. So to get these high heat flows, we need an efficient process of getting this tidal heating out from the middle of Enceladus to the outside. And water is a much more efficient way of doing that than if it was just, say, bedrock and then ice. It would be difficult to get, even more difficult to get those numbers.
Well, what are the implications if we pretend that it was rock instead? What would the implications be? Would Enceladus be warmer overall or cooler, or maybe it's even the wrong sample answers?
It's a good question. I guess that the center would be warmer, would be my guess, because I mean you're still squishing it and releasing it, and it's not able to move the heat out as efficiently. So I imagine you'd have a warmer core, would be my kind of top of the hat guess.
Okay.
But it's going to be difficult to move that heat out from the core to the surface to get those temperatures that we see there.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Like maybe not. Well, thank you very much, Carly. That was very thorough and very interesting. So appreciate it. So to the audience out there, there's no CHARM telecon for December. We cancel as usual and look for a CHARM announcement after the first of the year for our schedule. And thanks a lot for the speaker and audience, too. Bye-bye.